to the Creative Pen Podcasts. I'm Joanna Penn, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options, internet sales and promotion for your book. The companion website is www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show.
Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm interviewing Jo Giacalone. Jo is a law enforcement supervisor with an extensive background in criminal investigations, including the Cold Case Homicide Squad, and he holds the Medal of Valor. He also has an MA in criminal justice, teaches criminal investigation, and is the author of The Criminal Investigative Function, A Guide for New Investigators. So welcome, Jo.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, thanks so much for coming on the show. And I know all the crime writers are so excited about this interview.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, maybe you could just give us a very quick, you know, bit more of a background about yourself.
Okay. I'm 19 years in the New York City Police Department. I've spent most of that time investigating criminal investigations, going after bad guys almost the whole time, if it was from in fugitive enforcement or, like I said, in the cold case squad, which was you know, the best time I've had in the police department. And I'm also an adjunct professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. I've been there for almost 6 years. And I'm teaching. It was one of the reasons why I wrote the book, too, because I was teaching from other people's books. And I'm like, why don't I just write my own? So that's where how that came about.
Yeah, no, you're a multi-talented guy, that's for sure.
Yeah, so I try to be.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you, I mean, obviously most of the people who listen to my podcast are writers, and a lot of us do write about crime and about criminals and all of this stuff. So I wanted to, you know, you've obviously got huge experience in the criminal justice system. So what is it that writers get wrong, you know, at the basics? You know, what is romanticized? What's just plain wrong about the details and technology?
Well, one of the things I've noticed from some of the crime writing that I've read is that we kind of fall into this CSI Miami black hole where we have to, you know, we rush it. We have to have a murder. We have to have an investigation. We have to have a court trial all in 45 minutes with three commercials. You know, so we kind of rush these things. So, and it's you couldn't be further from the truth, because one of the things about investigations, you have to take your time. That's when you make mistakes. And, you know, we've kind of fallen in love with the technology and the forensic science stuff with the DNA and, you know, and we'll sit back and wait for it. The lab said it's this guy, you know. I guess I'm a purist at heart. So I kind of like the old good old fashioned police work where, you know, the knocking on doors, the canvases, you know, those kind of things. And sometimes we've gotten away from that in the new age.
Mm. No, that's really interesting. So, well, then let's ask you this then. If writers are meant to take their time a bit more, but you know that a good book has to keep hooking the people along the way. What other aspects should people be focusing on?
Well, one of the things I think that we could do is, for a crime novel, I mean, most of the time you spend your time talking to people. So dialogue has got to be extremely important for a crime writer. The narration is, you know, is important, but not as much. So I think that we can slow the process down by still going through the dialogue and still be able to create the atmosphere of the tension and stuff like that, especially with dialogue. If you get a chance to really do it, like, you know, for instance, people should read your book, how you create some of those scenes where the dialogue, you know, it gets people excited about what to read next. That's what you have to do.
Okay. And is it, I don't know much about police work at all, but do you, when you go and interview people, do you, like when you do door knocking, do you record as people speak or do people still take notes?
No, what we do is we have to take notes, like on a notepad, and, you know, just from what we have, what happens is that somebody knocks on the door and you have to just be able to, you know, get them to tell you the information. Yeah, don't worry about that. That was my wife that just snuck by. It's about getting information from people. Sometimes, you know, imagine knocking on people's doors at 3 o'clock in the morning and saying, "Now, could you help us out?" You know, you have to be able to build that rapport rather quickly with some people, and some people are better at it than others. Depends on if you're a person that you're easily to talk to, and people will provide you information that they normally wouldn't provide otherwise.
Yeah, and can you, you know, can you tell pretty quickly if people are hiding something? Is that something you get to know?
Yeah, you know what? In this business, when you're doing it for a long period of time, you tend to pick up on people's nonverbal body cues. It's not the be all and end all. Sometimes, I mean, we have a whole show on TV, like Lie to Me, where it just goes through, you know, people's nonverbal. There is a lot to that, but it's something I wouldn't base my entire speech with, because you have to be careful with that, because different cultural cues that people have. You know, some cultures, like, somebody won't look at you in the eye, but like in our culture, if you can't look at us in our eyes, we think you're lying to us, you know. So that's something that you have to be careful about. So the cross-cultural issues are big.
That's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up. It's so, you know, easy to forget that that's so true. So you're right. And would that depend on which neighborhoods, I guess, you were in? You adjust your behavior accordingly.
Well, it's not so much that, but you know, you have to know your audience, just like a writer has to know who they're writing to. You know, you have to pick out the type of audience that you want to, you know, if you want to read your book. And same thing happens in police work when you're going, like, say, New York City. We have many different neighborhoods that come from so many different backgrounds, and which is also good, is that, you know, we're pretty much integrated, and we have different cops from different areas that can help us out with some of those cues.
I could so ask you so many things, but
yeah, go ahead. Do it.
I did actually.
That's what we're here for. This is fun.
It is. It is fun. Okay, so I wanted to ask you about, you know, crime writers invent these detective characters. They're the main sort of characters, and you know, we've got the cops. And you know, what do you consider the most important character traits that, you know, for real, for that makes a good detective or a good policeman?
Well, you know, it's a great question. There are certain things you have to have. First of all, you have to be persistent. All right, you can't give up on this thing. Investigating cold cases 20, 30 years old, I mean, if people gave up, then we wouldn't solve any of these cases. So being persistent, being determined, you're not going to be deterred. And it happens not only from the investigations where maybe that you were hoping that their DNA would prove, or you couldn't find the evidence anymore. I mean, those are all things that could kill your investigation, but you need to go on and try to develop additional leads, find other witnesses, talk to people. Which is leads me to, like, the third one is being a good communicator. You have to know how to talk to people. I mean, building that rapport, and you have that second to read somebody, find out where, you know, what type of information you think you're going to get out of them. And listen, building rapport, it sounds like it's an easy thing, but it really isn't. So you have to find different ways. I mean, even if you go into the person's house and they have a picture of their kids on the wall, you know, say, oh, you know, these are your kids. Yeah, I'm a dad too. Or, you know, I listen, and I don't care if they're the ugliest kids in the world. You say, oh, how beautiful those kids are. Anything to get yourself into a conversation.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what you got to do first. Because sometimes you just don't knock on somebody's door and say, hey, listen, I'm here to investigate the murder. You know, you don't want to do that. So you don't want to scare people either. You know, sometimes people don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Or if you have somebody that is going to, you think is not going to give you help, because sometimes some of the neighborhoods might not be very police friendly. So I might knock on the door and say, you know, I'm here to investigate the robbery. And they're like, I don't know anything about a robbery. But, you know, I said, good, because I was here about the shooting instead. So, you know, I mean, you can trick people into it. Some take it and laugh, and other people, you know, they'll slam the door in your face. But that's just sometimes a chance you got to take.
Yeah. And what about, like you said there, some people don't like police. And, you know, I personally don't understand that. But, of course, you know, some people have cultural issues with police. So what sort of character trait do you need to deal with that? I mean, presumably you can't actually be a kind of angry, violent person. Otherwise, you might react to some of the stuff that you get. I mean, maybe you get stuff thrown at you. I don't know. I mean, do people
attack
you?
Yeah, well, in some places you have to, before you walk into a building, you have to look up. Because you have to worry about the airmail, they call it. You know, people raining stuff down on you. And it happens from time to time. And you have to be careful about that. So your tactics and your training and all those different things that you've learned throughout the years or quite frankly learned from other people's mistakes, some of them unfortunate, but you have to, you know, make sure you're always on your guard. And, you know, you have to have a purpose when you walk in there, knowing exactly what type of information. And this is another good tip for writers in respect that try to, when you're writing your characters and you're investigating a crime, there's you pretty much are in the initial stages, you're fishing for information, you know, and we have to make sure we don't do that when we do our interrogation, because we're going to find out later on that when we do our interrogation, that's something totally different.
Right. And I just also wanted to ask about your gun. Because, okay. You know, because in England, well, it used to be before 9/11 and whatever, people didn't have guns, which is when I lived right. in England. But do policemen really run around with their guns out all the time like this, like we see on TV?
Yeah, no, it's not like CSI Miami. Nobody's driving around in a Hummer either, you know. And there aren't any palm trees in New York City either or any of the outer boroughs. But no, I mean, you only take your gun out if there's going to be a situation where you feel that your life is going to be in danger. I mean, and I also like the, what I call it, the Charlie's Angels things where they all have their hand, you know, they up in the air like they're going to shoot a pigeon out of the sky. But, you know, as that couldn't be further from the truth anyway. If you ever took your gun out, it would always be pointed down so that if there was an accidental discharge, you wouldn't, you know, hit anybody, especially in a place like New York City where everybody's on top of one another and it's dangerous. So you don't take that thing out unless you have to.
Mm. No, exactly. So being a bit cautious. Okay, so I wanted to ask you, you know, oh, no, one more question about cops. We get this stereotype, you know, either there's the burnt out, cynical cop that is, you know, at the end of their career or whatever, or there's the, you know, sort of stereotypes we have. Are any of those true or are most people kind of middle of the road?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things to be cynical about. I mean, you're dealing with the worst that society has to offer. Some people, depends on your personality, take it better than others. So you could end up with some people that were, you know, burnt out. But those are the guys or girls that were been very into their job and busy and running around, you know, for years. I mean, think about it, you're doing this for 20 years. As you get older, we all know that we start slowing down and things annoy us a little more than everything else. So, I mean, listen, the police department is just a microcosm of the regular world. I mean, you get people who are burnt out accountants. So, I mean, you come to a point where, you know, that's why it's a 20-year retirement, because they know there's a specific limit on how much you can take, you know, how many child molesters and murderers and rapists and stuff like that you can deal with before you, you know, start becoming even more cynical. It all depends. I mean, we have lots of defense mechanisms. We laugh a lot. We sometimes, I've been accused, I don't know why, of being sarcastic, but I couldn't tell you why. But, you know, it's just a defense mechanism. I mean, that's what people have to understand, too. Yeah, like I said, we're just normal people. Just because we put a uniform on or do something like that doesn't make us different than anybody else.
Well, it does actually make you kind of braver and better than a lot of us, to be honest.
Other people would think it'd be a lot dumber than everybody else too, because you know, they're in a nice office somewhere, probably making a lot more money than I am. But you know, hey, listen, it's not. Not everybody can do it, but I said it's enjoyable. It's good that you're doing something, giving back to society.
Yeah.
And you try to protect the people who can't protect themselves. And that's what it's all about.
Yeah. No, that's okay. So what about the criminals then? Because, you know, we've got the stereotype cop on one hand, and a lot of people write stereotypical criminals. And obviously there are some really bad people out there. That's a given. But are there, you know, situations where you just look at people and think, you know, given some circumstance, we could all be there? You know, are a lot of criminals like normal people?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times it's, I would say, when you have a criminal, you got MOM. It's MOM's an acronym, means, opportunity, and motive. And the opportunity sometimes, you know, appears itself, and people who normally wouldn't do something would do it. And it depends. Some people do it because based on their economic situation, too. And not everybody's a bad, bad person. But one of the things that writers do, they give too much credit to the bad guys. They make them like these masterminds. And quite frankly, most of them aren't. So if they were masterminds, they'd still be running around. I mean, the people who haven't been caught are far, you know, few and far between than the people who do get caught. You know, I mean, look, we have people that rob banks. I mean, we have the most sophisticated bank robbers, and they walk in with nothing on their face and like they don't think they're going to get caught. So. You know, there are never, they said, don't make them so smart.
Don't those people have TVs?
Yeah, apparently, right? It's amazing what people do it, and you say to yourself, like, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, recently, there's a guy who robbed the bank. He left his ransom note there on a back of his deposit ticket with his name and address on the other side. So, I mean, yeah, they're not rocket scientists, so we make them these criminal masterminds too. So, but I understand it's fiction, and we want to be able to keep the writers, keep the readers in suspense. But you know what? One time I'd like to see a character who just isn't that sophisticated, and I think that would be actually a funny idea. where somebody can use.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, that's fantastic. And I guess, you know, does it, and I had a question I was going to ask you later, but I'm going to ask you now. So, you know, I wonder why we're so attracted to this violent stuff. You know, we do, you know, I'm excited about interviewing you about this, you know, and what these TV shows everywhere. And, you know, in my own book, I've written about murder and death and things. Why are humans so interested in this, the stuff, do you think?
Well, you know, I think about it. I mean, I guess from our evolutionary times, I guess when we were fighting for food in the caves, I mean, it's kind of innate in all of us, unfortunately. Some of us go the opposite way in society. But I think, you know, I mean, listen, one of the things about teaching, I learned a lot about the different criminological theories, and writers should read some of them. Not all of them, because there's tons of them, and some of them, you know, I don't pay much mind to. But, for instance, such as like the social bond theory, like Travis Hershey, Emily Durkheim, and basically they wrote that, you know, everybody could be a criminal except for there's certain things that keep us grounded. One of those is attachment, you know, having a family and, you know, you don't want to be embarrassed. And like, for instance, when I was a young boy, my father said, listen, if the cops ever bring you home and they ask you where you live, tell them JFK, which is the airport right here in New York. You know, that's where you live. That's where you're going. Get on a plane and go somewhere. So the attachment's big. So, you know, families are important. And, you know, if you want to keep your kids out of trouble, I mean, that's where it starts, at home. And other things that you know, the commitment, having going to school, having going to job, and that keeps a lot of people grounded. Like, you don't want to be embarrassed. If you don't want your picture on the front page of the paper, then you know, then you're going to stay on the other side. But, you know, I think they've come to a point where they realize that everybody could do it. Mm. You know, and just what keeps certain people from doing it and not is a fine line, I think, that we haven't discovered. But you know what? If you and I discover, we should write our own book and make lots of money.
I know, I'm interested in some of those theories, actually, because, you know, that, like, they do say there are markers about, you know, cruelty to animals and stuff like that, you know, can lead into these things. I think writers do need to look at these theories so we can make sure we do that to our characters, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think some writers could actually, if they look at some of them, like conflict theory, social learning is just what it sounds like. We learn from the others that we grew up with, you know. Mom and dad are the most important initially, then our friends, and then, you know, when we turn 25 and so, and you have your own, start having your own family, you don't realize how much mom and dad learned over those last couple of years. You know, we kind of make mistakes, but it's they could help out people with their writing for sure, because you can come up with different avenues and different things about some of these sociological theories, because that's what it's based on. It's all sociology, you know, and psychology also.
Yeah. And do you think, I mean, I know, you know, police workers like yourself are on the, you know, see all of this violence and stuff, but most of us don't see it. And I wonder whether or not we almost feel like we don't live on the edge, you know, in a lot of our office worker lives. So we kind of watch these shows because it makes life a bit more exciting.
Well, it might, because if you look at it, every time you turn the channel on, there's a new police show. I mean, there are hundreds of them. I mean, I can't believe it. It's funny. My mother's very into it. She watches all these shows, and then she asked me, oh, like, you know, what about this? Do you guys do that? And do you guys, it's like, no, Ma, this is television, you know. People ask me all the time, you know, what's the show that's closely related to what you do? You know, is it CSI Miami? Is it NYPD Blue? I tell them it's Barney Miller, which was a comedy going back from the 70s. If you had a chance to watch him on YouTube or Hulu, maybe. Yeah. Barney Miller that's probably the closest to reality of what detective work is really like. You know, you can, if you haven't seen an episode, you should watch a couple. You'll see, like, you know, it's pretty funny.
Right, I'll check that out. Okay, so we were going to talk also about interrogation techniques, but because that's something you teach as well, isn't it? So, yes. You know, presumably you use a lot of psychology, and, you know, how do you get people to give themselves up, basically?
Well, you know, first, it always starts with a good introduction. You always, you know, say who you are, you know. Writers have to understand, when you're doing an interrogation, the questions that you have, you already know the answers to. This is not a fishing expedition. And, you know, the hardest people to talk to what we call it the box, which is the interrogation room. The hardest people to talk to are the people who've been through the system a number of times. Mm-hmm. In a situation, let's say, where we have several people arrested, you know, I might sit and look at them in the jail cell for a while and see who I'd like to talk to first. It isn't going to be the guy sleeping on the bench. It's not going to be the guy, you know, playing tic-tac-toe or whatever. it's going to be the guy that's holding on to the bars like this, you know, trying to get out. He's going to be my first person I want to talk to. So we spend a lot of time just watching them. And, you know, because we have this, there's an old saying that the guilty always sleep. As soon as you put them in the, cell, they go right to sleep. You know, it's a phenomenon. It's something that I've witnessed several times. Because when you first hear it, you're like, no way. But a lot of times when somebody's been on the run for a long time, they kind of like, okay, it's over. I can rest now. So, but listen, we're allowed to lie. We're allowed to trick. We can deceive. Fabricating is a whole other issue. So, you know, I see it on TV sometimes. You know, they come up with a DNA program, they go, the fingerprint, here's your fingerprints, whatever. You have to be very careful with that, especially in the United States. We've had a couple of Supreme Court cases. One said it was, a local Supreme Court cases. One in Florida, you know, said it was good, and another one in Nevada said it wasn't good. So you have to be careful with that. But yeah, we can lie. Yeah, remember, think about this for a second. We're taught to lie from the time we're born, basically. Right, we're taught that there are good lies and bad lies. Right? We don't want to tell Aunt Mary that you know, her mustache is looking, you know, not looking too good today. So we have to say, oh yeah, you look great, Aunt Mary. You know, so I mean, this is, and we've told that that's good because you don't want to hurt people's feelings and stuff like that. And then as you get older, we become better liars, you know, and get you ready for the inevitable question: where does this make me look fat? Yeah, of course. Yeah, what would you like us to say? Of course, it does, right? So we've learned how to be really good liars. And if you think about this, if you're under arrest, you're in the box waiting to be interrogated, and you're sitting there thinking about all this, and you're going to dig your heels in because the stakes are much higher now. This isn't about hurting Aunt Mary's feelings or anything like that. This is, you know, you could go to jail the rest of your life, or in certain places, you're going to get the death penalty. So those denials are going to come up pretty quickly, and you have to try to get people off those denials. And that's where the tricky part comes in. But yeah, it's all about psychology. It's all about being prepared, which would be another one of the things where your characters must be always prepared. And for instance, let's say if you're writing a story about a sexual murderer, you might want to sit him down first, and before you even start, just say, you know, do you know what DNA is? And let it, and then say, okay, I have some other questions. And just let that sink in for a little while. Because what the bad guy's thinking is, do they have my DNA? Yeah, I didn't say I did. Didn't say I didn't. But you plant the seed, and you know, and these are the tactics that have been said that these are okay because, hey, listen, they're lying to me the whole time, so why shouldn't I be able to lie to them, right? Mm-hmm. So
wow.
It's an interesting thing. It's real cat and mouse. Talk about that.
And how long are you in there in the box?
It could be 5 minutes. It could be hours. There's no rules. As long as the person is provided ample breaks, where if they have to take a nap, if they want to eat, they want to go to the bathroom. All those things have to be documented, but you could go on 12 hours, 14 hours. Mm. Some of the ones that I thought, you know, you call your wife and say, listen, it's going to be a late night tonight, you know, and you walk in, you sit down, and the guy's like, all right, I killed her. You know, what? You know, I swear to God, sometimes you're just like, you're shocked. And then you have, you know, a person maybe that didn't have a lot of experience in the criminal justice system, you're like, oh, this is going to be a slam dunk. Mm. You know, 8 hours later, you're in there. So yeah. Each one you have to be, you have to approach dynamically. It's each case is different, and it depends on how prepared you are if you're going to be able to get the confession.
Now
that's ultimately what the goal is.
Yeah, of course. And I guess I was just thinking then about the cultural thing and the fact that you probably have a lot of people who don't speak English as well, or maybe pretend they don't speak English. I don't know. But so when you're working through an interpreter, does that happen a lot? I mean, do you have to do that?
It happens. It happens quite often. For instance, the New York City Police Department, we're so diverse. We have people that speak all the different languages, so it's not very difficult to find somebody. The problem is, though, as the interrogator, when you're trying to ask those questions, it kind of puts you at a disadvantage in the respect that you have to wait for the translations to always come through. Mm-hmm. So it's like being on delay where, you know, I ask the question and I got to wait till it gets interpreted, and then I have to wait to hear the answer, then it has to get interpreted again. And one of the concerns is the interpreter giving me everything, you know, or is he, you know, cutting certain things out? So that makes it difficult at times. But, you know, quite fortunately, where we have somebody, it's most of the time, you know, English speaking or Spanish speaking is probably the second most important language. But we have plenty of detectives that speak Spanish, too. So this becomes, you know, not a big issue.
Mm.
You know, in a big department like ours, it's not a big issue. But in small departments, it could be a potential problem.
Right, because I was just thinking then about the body language. I love the tip about the sleeping. That's brilliant. Is there any other, you know, little pointers you can give us that, you know, could be interesting about body language in a interrogation room?
Well, one of the things that you look for, like for instance, if you're starting to talk to somebody and they're going to go right into their denials, what they do is they sit back and they put their hands across their chest, you know, which we all know is the you know, the nonverbal cue for I'm not opening up to you. Or they'll put their leg on top, you know, they'll cross their legs, they'll put their leg on top of their knee. And you'll find that as you get more and more into the interrogation, sometimes people start closing up even closer. They'll try to even scrunch up on the chair. So you kind of know when you're hitting the right chords. But sometimes you need to back off those things too, because I want you to relax again. I want you to get back into it. So if I think I hit a nerve where I kind of hit on something, like the other person, you know, has that moment like, oh no, you know, the old no moment. You have to be cognizant of that, and you have to be able to pick up on it. And when you do, you might want to back off just a little bit on your questioning, because what happens is if you could shut this person down by keep on, you know, going after them, like in television, you know, they're going crazy, yelling at people and stuff like that. That's it couldn't be further from the truth. You have to be able to schmoosh people, get them to, you know, give you that information. But a lot of times it's just that whole psychology part where, you know, we need to get to the bottom of this, or, you know what, get your story out, that kind of thing. You know, don't you want them to hear your side of the story? Mm. And a lot of people go for that. The rationalizations are big. You know, I understand why you did this. I would do the same thing. Mm. You know, even if you're, you know, remember, you're lying. I mean, you're not going to tell a rapist who did something like, you know, I understand she was wearing these, you know, sexy clothes, and I would have done the same thing. But, you know, she was asking for it. That's kind of, you know, I mean, that's that. But that's the rationalization that some people have to be put through in order to you understand that. You know, they're not pleasant to put people through, and they're not pleasant certainly to go through it. And you don't believe any of this stuff. So that's the hard part, because you're lying yourself. So you have to be careful, because if you get caught in a lie, then the whole thing is going to come to pieces on you.
Yeah.
But it's definitely one of those things where a riveting interrogation scene where somebody builds that into, you could write a whole book just on an interrogation.
Hmm.
You know, from front to back, you can have your killing, and then you can have that interrogation, your whole book. I mean, you could really make a fascinating book about the different nuances that happen in the confession room.
Wow, that's so interesting. Now, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, you know, what do you find the most rewarding thing about your job? I mean, why do you continue to do your job?
Well, especially in regards to when the cold case investigations, I mean, some of these cases have been open for so many years, and when you're finally able to call the mother or call the next of kin and say, listen, we made an arrest in your father's murder or your brother's murder, those are the things that you're doing it for. You know, you're the last advocate for people sometimes. Mm. They don't have a voice anymore. And, you know, somebody's got to stand up for them. So it becomes the, you know, the proverbial, like, you know, the knight in shining armor kind of thing, where you're carrying on for somebody who can't or can't speak anymore. Or, you know, you're dealing with the elderly victims or unfortunately, the child victims, where you're basically their caretaker. And, you know, that's why you do it. I mean, that's because there are a lot of bad people out there, you know, and that's the kind of the thing where you have to make sure that you stay above the law also, because you don't want to lose your job over doing things. I mean, you have to be very grounded, you know, you have to be very grounded. And, you know, cops get themselves in trouble sometimes when they're not. So, yeah, you got to be careful of that.
Hmm. And is that something you teach to your students as well, about how to actually cope with life? Yes.
Yeah, they ask you all the kids are very their kids are very interested in, and that's one of the reasons why I like teaching so much. People say, well, you like, you know, they ask me, hey, would you like to do online classes? No, I don't want to do online classes. I like going into the classroom. I like talking to the kids. A lot of them have great questions, and some of them are very interested in it. And unfortunately, a lot of them are products of the CSA Miami crowd. You know, they watch it all on television, and that's what they want to do. And I try to explain to them that's not reality, you know, you're not going to be doing that kind of stuff. But they say police work is 7 hours of boredom and 1 hour of sheer terror, and that's basically what it comes down to. But when you watch television, it's always action, always something going on. But thank God it's not like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, so where can people find you and your book and your other sites? Because you've got the Cold Case blog and some other things.
Right. Well, the book is available through, but you can get it through any bookstore or Amazon.com, of course. I mean, that's probably the easiest way to go because you get the free shipping. So that's always a bonus. You don't have to leave your house anymore. It's great. You know what? I was really surprised. The Kindle sales on the book. I mean, I was really surprised over that. So the Kindle's really that's a great thing. I write a blog called the Cold Case Squad blog, you know, in my spare time between teaching and working and writing, right? So I don't have too much spare time. But thecoldcasesquad.com is my blog. And I also have an author site, Joe G. Writes, because nobody can pronounce my last name. So I had to come up with something real short. So I put the joegwrites.com, and I put up some articles on there. I'm starting to put up some crime writing articles, like things like Miranda issues and stuff like that. So writers can take a look at some of those things.
No, it's a fantastic resource. You've just got so much brilliant information. Well, thanks ever so much for coming on the show, Joe. That was brilliant.
Thanks for having me. I really had a great time. Actually, I can't believe how fast that half hour flew.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can get more information on writing, publishing options, sales, and promotion for your book at www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And you can also get your free How to Be an Author workbook at www.howtobeanauthor.com. See you next time!